Fancy a game?
I would hope you just explain math to them.
What? Like we're too self-referential.
Is that how analytics work?
I think I did my math right.
I do not trust your math at all.
Technically correct.
And people call us smug.
With Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, Sam Boyd Stadium. Marvin Coleman had a triple-double, and it might not have even been the most impressive performance by a Rebel on Saturday. And Pete DeBoer is just Gerard Gallant. But we start with the NFL and the Raiders, because it feels like the Raiders are going to be screwed as long as Patrick Mahomes is in the AFC West. In the two seasons that Pat Mahomes has been a starter, the Chiefs are 23-7 in games that he started. The Raiders have won 17 games over the last 3 years. Mahomes has made it to the AFC Championship game twice in his 2 years as a starter. He is now in the Super Bowl this season. One of his playoff games did go to overtime, but in all four playoff games he's played in, they've scored at least 31 points. It feels like the Kansas City Chiefs are going to dominate the AFC West for a while, because Pat Mahomes is 24. He is by far the best quarterback in the division and probably the best quarterback in the NFL. It's really funny if you look at the division and compare Patrick Mahomes, because the Chargers have Phillip Rivers right now, but probably not for very long, and we'll see what they go with in the offseason. The Broncos maybe have Drew Lock, although it doesn't sound like they're 100% sold on Drew Lock being their starting quarterback next year. And the Raiders are sitting here still trying to figure out if Derek Carr is any good. It's a 6-year mystery. Is this guy good? So it's very
maybe
funny.
Maybe year 7 he'll put it all together.
Because there is legitimately one team in the division that knows what they have at their quarterback position. And they know that because he's really good. And it feels like the Raiders and the Broncos and the Chargers, you can add them to this list too, don't really have much of a chance. The other part about Mahomes that sucks for the Raiders is he specifically highlights what the Raiders are worst at, and that is defending the pass. The Raiders have been very poor in coverage, whether it's been linebackers or safeties or cornerbacks the last couple of years, and they've been very poor at rushing the passer. Even this year, where Max Crosby has a breakout season as a rookie, they're still overall bottom 10 in the NFL in pressure rating. So it's hard to see the Raiders catching the Chiefs while Pat Mahomes is there, but I do have some optimism. Granted, it's about 3 seasons away, but there is some reason for optimism, and it comes back to Pat Mahomes' rookie contract. His cap hit this season, $4.5 million. The Chiefs have the most valuable piece an NFL team can have, and that's a good quarterback on a rookie contract, and Mahomes is more than good. You can probably make the argument that, what, Pat Mahomes and who else would fit in that list? I don't think you'd put Kyler Murray in that list right now, but Pat Mahomes and Lamar Jackson are the two most valuable if you compare what they mean to wins and how much they're getting paid. Those are probably the two most valuable players in the NFL.
I want to still believe in Baker, but I can't.
No. It's
I said I want to.
It's Mahomes and it's Lamar Jackson. There's a lot of value in Baker Mayfield because he's not making a lot of money. There's a lot of value in Kyler Murray because he's not making a lot of money, but those two haven't actually translated to wins just yet. 2020, Pat Mahomes is still on his rookie contract. 2021 would be the 5th-year option the Chiefs can extend on Pat Mahomes. So for the next 2 seasons, I don't see any way the Raiders can be better than the Chiefs, because the Chiefs are significantly better at quarterback and paying him significantly less. And what that means is the Kansas City Chiefs can put a significantly better roster around their quarterback, because the Raiders are spending 20 plus million, or the cap hit is 20 plus million on Derek Carr, whereas Pat Mahomes is 4.5. So they have effectively $15 million more dollars they can spend on their roster. So their roster can be better and their quarterback is significantly better. So I don't see how the Raiders could actually catch the Chiefs, because they've got the most valuable thing you can have in the NFL. Now, where the optimism comes in is that when Pat Mahomes' rookie contract is up, he's going to get what? $45 million a year? Like, by the time we get to 2022 and he's a free agent, or not a free agent, you'd assume the Chiefs are going to get him locked up before that happens, but that deal is going to be what? Like, how much your quarterback's going to be getting paid then? $45 million, maybe $50 million? Like, that's what Pat Mahomes is going to get. So he's going to go from his cap hit being like $5 million, and it's going to be 10 times higher at $45 or $50 million. So when that happens, the Chiefs roster will become significantly worse around him because now they don't have that much money to spend on the rest of their players.
Except you might also wind up with the Russell Wilson situation where who is he throwing to? It doesn't matter.
Yes, there's probably going to be a window where Pat Mahomes, he comes off his rookie contract. He'll be, what, 26, 27, roughly?
Yeah.
When he comes off his rookie contract, he'll probably have 3, 4, 5 seasons where he's still so good that it doesn't matter who's out there. You just have to hope, if you're the Chiefs, you have to hope that he has a good defense, right? But the offensive players, it won't matter. And then probably when he hits 32, he's going to need some good players around him.
He'll readjust his contract. It'll get converted to a bonus, and then,
That's what you're hoping for if you're the Chiefs. But that is where your window opens up if you're the Raiders, because the only way your window opens now is if Pat Mahomes gets hurt. And hell, that happened this year, and they're still in the Super Bowl. Like, that happened, and you still didn't come close to winning the division.
Think about you're the Raiders, and you're just like, ha, 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 they're starting Matt Moore. Oh, didn't matter. Didn't matter. False alarm.
Not at all. So that's really the only way your window is open if you're the Raiders or the Broncos or the Chargers for the next two seasons. The good news for John Gruden is he got a 10-year contract. He can wait out Pat Mahomes' rookie contract. And then Pat Mahomes gets $50 million, and John Gruden is just like, all right, we're ready to go now. There is one way.
We finally figured out Derek Carr.
He's good now. There is one way the Raiders could actually catch or almost match the value that Pat Mahomes brings in a salary cap sport. And that's if pretty much all of their all of the players that have been drafted by John Gruden get even better. Like, they had a good season from Max Crosby. They had a good season from Josh Jacobs. They had a good season from Hunter Renfro, right? They got good value from those three players this season. They need them to be even better. When Jonathan Abram finally plays next season, they need him to be excellent. They need Colton Miller, who they took a couple years ago in the first round as left tackle, to stop being one of the 10 worst offensive tackles in the NFL. They need him to become a top half offensive tackle in the NFL. Whoever they draft in the first round this year, if it's a linebacker and a wide receiver, they need that linebacker to be a above average starting linebacker in the NFL, and they need that wide receiver to be a true number one wide receiver. They need basically 7, 8, maybe 10 of the guys they've drafted to be excellent. Because again, you have the same benefit as Pat Mahomes, where those guys are on a rookie contract, so they're getting paid much less than what their value could be. So if Jonathan Abram becomes one of the best safeties in football, right, you're not paying him very much for the first five seasons, but he's giving you production at the top end of the NFL. Same with Jacobs, same with Max Crosby, same with Hunter Renfro, same with whoever they take this year. Like, you can get tremendous value. The problem is none of those guys play the position that Pat Mahomes plays, and Pat Mahomes plays the position that has the biggest impacts on wins and losses. And so you're going to need 7 or 8 of those guys to match the value that Patrick Mahomes gives you. So if they can get 7 or 8 or 9 of those guys to be sort of top 5 in their position while they only have to pay them a few million dollars or even less in Max Crosby's case, then you've got a shot. But you've got to be really good. Like, that is, you've got to be unbelievably great at drafting guys and then those guys developing into something good. You can't have any more Cleveland Furls. You can't be drafting guys 4th overall that are like, he would have been a nice 2nd round pick. The Raiders ever get a 4th overall pick again, they've got to hit a home run on, right? They've got to go do better than Cleveland Furrow was. Cleveland Furrow's fine, but he's drafted him 4th overall.
Josh Allen would have been great.
It would have been excellent. Josh Allen and Max Crosby would have been fantastic. So there is a little bit of a way the Raiders can do it, because they do, since John Gruden's taken over, they've had a lot of draft capital to use. Like, John Gruden, they've been put, because they traded Khalil Mack and Amari Cooper, and because they've been bad, they've had a lot of draft capital to where they can improve this team and have a lot of young guys on rookie contracts, but you've got to hit on those, and not just hit on them to where, oh, they're pretty good. You've got to hit on them to where, oh, wow, they are amazing. They are fantastic. They are excellent. Like, it's got to be top 5 at your position type of good. Like, how good Josh Jacobs was as a running back, he's got to do that again and be healthy for the whole season, and then you need Renfro and Crosby and Colton Miller to all do similar types of things. Is there anything better than Tom Brady and Mark Davis talking to each other at a UFC fight?
I mean, for this, like, for this local media, no. But at the same time, it's also like, of course they're gonna, like, it's a fight. Who care? Who? Why are they talking? Like, don't do this to us.
It's hilariously stupid. Like, just the, yeah, they're standing next to each other. They say hello. Somebody took a picture of it. Here it is. Like, it's hilariously stupid that's like, oh my God, Mark Davis is talking to Tom Brady. It's wonderful, though. Like, it's absolutely wonderful because, listen, Tom Brady is number two on the technically correct fun meter for offseason acquisitions for the Raiders. Jameis Winston, still number one, because I want 30 picks, 30 touchdowns under John Gruden.
I want it higher. I wanted 40-40.
That's a good point, yes. 40-40 would be wonderful.
I want him to somehow average a triple-double.
But Gruden and Brady would be terrific because Derek Carr is the quarterback that's going to do whatever his quarterbacks ask him. He is a people pleaser. So, like, when John Gruden says something, Derek Carr is yes, sir, and he's going to do it. I'm pretty sure if Tom Brady's the quarterback, there's going to be multiple times, and hopefully at some point in the media, where Tom Brady says, no, that's wrong. Like, tells John Gruden,
I don't think we're going to do it that way.
He's like, no, that's not going to work. Whereas Derek Carr is going to say, nope, great game plan. This is like, that's what he's always going to say. I'm pretty sure Tom Brady would say, no, no, that's not going to work. So I am on board for the storyline.
Just shows up to the press conference with all the rings and just sits there and goes, I didn't think it was a great offensive game plan, but what do I know?
It would be amazing. Like, I don't know how often that would happen in the media, but I have to think that would happen quite a bit. And the storylines there would be wonderful. Also, Tom Brady is a Raider. Hunter Renfrow is going to be the best receiver in football.
And then he's going to have to retire early due to concussion issues.
If Tom Brady, that's what we need to ask Bob Scucci on Thursday. If Tom Brady's a Raider, what are our odds on Hunter Renfrow leading the NFL in receptions?
And then 5 years later, having to get a specially designed helmet.
That is three times larger than a normal helmet.
That's still my favorite storyline, is that Tom Brady finds these little guys to run across the middle and then gives them permanent brain damage.
Hey. Just part of the game. Technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Go to beconnectedsports.com to download the mobile sports app for quick and easy betting from your phone or tablet. You can bet before the game or while you watch with in-game wagering. It is the Be Connected Sports app from Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Hey, it's Tyler Bischoff. The best spot to place your bets is the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook. But if you're looking for even more convenience, download the Be Connected Sports app from beconnectedsports.com. The Be Connected Sports app makes it easy to place bets from your phone or tablet and allows you to bet during the game. So download the Be Connected Sports app and you can be just a few clicks away from betting on the biggest games whenever you want. Boyd Gaming has you covered at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook or at beconnectedsports.com.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
Marcus Arroyo landed 9 commitments over the weekend.
It was a terrific weekend for Marcus Arroyo. They got 9 players to commit. 2 of them stick out. Linebacker Brennan Scott was committed to Kansas. He then decommitted. He had offers from USC, Texas, Oregon, Auburn, and a bunch of other Power 5 schools. 24/7 Sports rates him as the 3rd best recruit in UNLV football history. He's also the highest rated recruit of any Mountain West school in the 2020 class. He has a very high rating. He, though, is basically the same rating as Vic Viramontes was last season. Vic Viramontes was a backup linebacker on a bad defense last year. So do keep that in mind. But ultimately, it is very impressive for him to pull that off just when you look at the offers that he had. Also got LaShawn Bell, a defensive end who is one of the 15 best recruits in UNLV history. So Marcus Arroyo has gotten 2 pretty high caliber recruits. And the best part, they're on defense. UNLV's had a bad defense in how long?
When did they have a good one?
Yeah, I'm just saying forever. I assume at some point along the line they at least had one good defense.
Oh,
but
I can try to look it up, but I genuinely don't think that's ever been the case.
They also got Adam Plant to transfer from TCU. He was a highly rated three-star out of Bishop Gorman. He has 3 years left, though he does have to sit out this season unless he gets a waiver. I guess that's always possible, but it looks like he'll have to sit out. So they've landed defensive players that are highly rated. That is excellent for UNLV. So you look at the class for guys that'll play next year, the three best players in the class, Brennan Scott, Ronald Gillum, who's a wide receiver that was committed to Tony Sanchez, and then LaShawn Bell. So those are your three headliners right now. The rest are solid. The rest are pretty similar to what Tony Sanchez was landing. But my favorite recruit of the weekend was an offensive lineman named Tiger Shanks.
Yep.
I need him to be a star. I need Tiger Shanks to be excellent because I need a reason to come on the show and say Tiger Shanks every day.
I also need him to be a guard who just is like a mauler. Like Richie Incognito minus the problems of Richie Incognito.
So
just throwing linebackers.
Tiger Shanks, let's go. Let's be. I don't think I've ever have cheered for an offensive lineman as much as I will for Tiger Shanks. But overall, Marcus Arroyo, it's kind of unbelievable. Like, they're still, I think, nationally, like, 89th in the country. So it's not like this is some top 50 class. But on the scale of UNLV football and on the scale of the Mountain West,
the top 100 class,
this is excellent. And the fact that Arroyo has come in and done this in, what, 2 months? From when he got hired to when the February signing day is tremendous. Like, that's unbelievable that he's been able to pull this off in this short time period. And it should make you excited, not necessarily about this recruiting class. Like, you should be. It's a good recruiting class right now, but for the future. Because if he can do this in 2 months, what can he do when he actually has a full cycle to recruit kids to UNLV? Especially if he comes in and has any sort of success on the field. Like, if he comes in and is able to go to a bowl game in year two, recruiting could be like the best it's ever been for UNLV.
It was nice having you.
Yeah, that too. That's a problem. That could be a problem. But that's like, you should be excited for what Marcus Arroyo could do in recruiting if this is what he's able to do right now.
What does our transfer portal look like?
I don't know. I haven't actually asked to get any sort of update on if anybody's in, but nobody's announced it on Twitter. No UNLV players have said, hey, I'm going into the transfer portal. So I don't know.
I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yes, you should. Absolutely. Every single play. Well, maybe not. I guess because once you go into the transfer portal, you technically don't have your scholarship anymore. Like, they can take your scholarship. So.
Yep. Nope. Screw you. You're stuck with me.
Yeah. So, I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, listen, when your coach leaves, you absolutely should consider going into the transfer portal, especially if you're good. Like, if you're Charles Williams said he's staying, but a player of Charles Williams' level, like, that guy should put his name in the transfer portal because, oh, other schools will want me.
UNLV has outscored Mountain West opponents by 53 points after halftime this season.
So the breakdown in conference play, they are plus 11 in the first half, they are plus 43 in the second half, and they are plus 10 in overtime. They have been pretty dominant after halftime in Mountain West play. So there's your stat if you're trying to find a way to say TJ Altzelberger is great at halftime adjustments. I'm a little hesitant to just use pure point differential as some sort of measure of coaching, in-game coaching, but it's probably not bad that you're outscoring opponents by 53 points in the second half. My favorite adjustment that he's made in-game was what he did against Wyoming defensively when they defensively show a 2-3 zone and then like halfway through the shot clock switch into man. And I still haven't asked him about it, and I need to because I don't understand why. Like, there's the obvious benefit of you're trying to confuse the offense so they don't know what you're doing, but it's very strange because they just sort of stand there in a 2-3 and teams will start their offense. Like, they'll start some sort of set or just their motion offense, and you're in a 2-3, and then, like, I don't know what their key is. I don't know if it's 15 on the shot clock or if there's a certain action that teams run that they're like, all right, that's when we go.
Third ball screen.
Right. I don't know what it is. But it's just like they just switch into man. And the interesting part to me is early in the season, UNLV struggled defensively picking up in transition. right? They would leave guys open in transition, which tends to be poor communication or awareness of where guys are. This is in the half court, but it's the same exact principle. You've got to have good communication and terrific awareness of where everybody is on the offense so that when you switch from zone to man, because like literally guys turn their backs to the ball to run and find the man they're now going to guard. You've got to be excellent at it, and they haven't gotten beat on it. Like, I don't know what the exact like points per possession are when they're in that versus when they're just in regular man to man, but like it's not like they've done this and as soon as they start to switch, somebody hits them for a backdoor cut and gets a dunk. Like, they're not giving up easy layups, so it seems like it's been effective, but it just seems so random. Like, what? I don't know what you're doing, but I don't know.
At what point do we just say this team's kind of good in the Mountain West?
I don't understand.
Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't want to say they're good, but they are in second place.
They are good, but it's like, how? I don't know.
The Packers winning 13 games.
Doesn't make sense.
The Lady Rebels beat New Mexico 68-51.
Not a close game. All their other wins keep requiring late comebacks. They got to go on a 15-0 run just to win games, but this one they just blew out New Mexico the whole way. So the Lady Rebels are 5-2 in the Mountain West, which is somehow only good for fourth on the women's side. There's a team that's 6-2 and 6-1 ahead of them. So only fourth at 5-2, but 2 points. Rajanae Wade is third in the Mountain West in scoring at 17 points per game and first in rebounding at 12 in conference play. And Letitia Smith is ninth in scoring and first in steals. So they've got two players that are playing extremely well this year. But right now, UNLV men's and women's basketball are a combined 11-3 in Mountain West play. Do you know what that means? UNLV is finally back to being a basketball school.
We led this segment off with 9 commits to the football team. Vanderbilt missed all 25 threes they shot against Tennessee.
Vanderbilt was one of three schools to have made a three in every game they played since the line was put in place. But now it is just Princeton and UNLV. The best part of this, though, was the crowd reaction and the coverage that SEC Network provided, because the SEC Network went split screen at the end of the game to show you the game and also the fans reacting to Vanderbilt not making three. So this is a game. Vanderbilt's at home, losing by 21. This is the final possession and what it sounded like on the SEC Network.
Steal. Pippen, does he sense it? Shoot okay, it. Saban Lee for three. And it rattles out. And by the way, Tennessee wins.
That is phenomenal. Because first off, how many times have you heard a crowd react to a missed shot at the buzzer by a team that's down 21 like that? Like, that might happen in a sports book when a team is a 20-point underdog, but not the home arena in Nashville, Tennessee. And second off, the announcers, fully aware. That's all that mattered to them in that last moment was, hey, they've made a three in every game and they haven't in this one, so they better put one up. Like, there was another point where it was like under 2 minutes to go. Vanderbilt scored on a layup and the crowd groaned. Because they wanted them to shoot a three. This would be spectacular to witness. If UNLV ever loses its streak, it better come at home. Because I want that. I want 20-point blowout where the only thing that matters is UNLV chucking threes. I want UNLV fouling on defense so they can get more possessions and more chances to shoot on three.
I think it was last year's home game against Nevada where it genuinely, after halftime, they hadn't hit a three, and there was a group next to the media section that every time they dribble up the court would just go, shoot it!
Yes.
Just...
anytime it gets into the second half, I don't think recently they've been under 10 minutes in the second half. I think they've always, there have been a couple of times where they've gone at halftime without one, but they usually hit one in the first 5 to 10 minutes. But God, if it happens, please happen at home, because I want the live crowd reaction to, oh my God, they haven't hit a three? Like, I want that, because it right after halftime is when it happens for UNLV teams, where it's like, okay, shoot a three, guys. Three! Like, let's go. Let's start putting it up. It'd be spectacular. And actually, like, The best thing is to tease it out, but actually make it. You know, like
they make
like imagine if Vanderbilt might have rushed the court if they had hit that three to lose by 18 points.
Tennessee's just like, all right, do they know we won? Okay, I'm confused. Boise State thinks they should continue to get more TV revenue than other Mountain West teams.
Tune in tomorrow when we'll talk about that. Coming up next, UNLV is 6-1 in the Mountain West, and the only way to describe Marvin Coleman is with the word magic.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Tyler Bischoff is
the dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically correct.
So maybe the best thing to see over the last couple of games for UNLV, aside from the fact that they're winning and they're in second place in the Mountain West, but TJ Otzelberger seems to be trusting his team more and trusting his team to do what he views as ideal basketball. If we go back to the preseason, TJ Otzelberger talked a lot about his offense, wanting to play with pace, how his teams at South Dakota State were among the fastest in the country. Get shots up in the first 10 seconds of the shot clock. That's the most efficient before the defense gets set. There were a lot of talking points before the season about his offense. Then we got into the actual season, and Otzelberger completely flipped. On the court, his team played slow. He started talking about offensive rebounding being a key to the offense. He started talking about defense being the identity of this team. Effort and focus are the things he keeps harping on. The identity of this team was the exact opposite of what TJ Otzelberger was doing at South Dakota State, and largely because he didn't think he had the players to do what he wanted to do. But in the last two games, UNLV has been playing extremely fast. Before the San Jose State and New Mexico games, UNLV was averaging 65 offensive possessions per game. Over the last two, they're averaging 77.5 possessions per game. That's 12.5 more possessions per game in the last two. Now, some of that has to do with the opponents they're playing. Both New Mexico and San Jose State play extremely fast as well. So those are teams that if you want to run, those are the teams that are going to let you run too. Like, they're perfectly fine with that. That's how they play. But Otzelberger wanted to run in these last two games, and that's the part that sticks out to me. In the non-conference and even before these last two, he didn't really have any interest in running. He wanted to play low possession games. He wanted to play low scoring games. He wanted effort and diving for loose balls to be the way his team won games. Now, San Jose State is a terrible transition defense team. They're awful up. That's a team that if you just simply pass the ball up the floor too quickly, you're going to get a layup because they're not going to know what to do. So it makes sense to do that. I thought New Mexico was going to be a little bit better defensively than San Jose State, but they weren't. New Mexico's terrible. I have not seen a team so incapable of guarding just simple stuff as I was with New Mexico.
I think that's more a Paul Weir issue than
it has to be. Like, because they're actually pretty good on offense. Like, their offense isn't bad. Like, what they're trying to do on offense, it's not too dissimilar from what Otzelberger ultimately wants to do. But they're just, like, defensively, it's just like, what in the world is going on with New Mexico? Like, UNLV, like, Marvin Menzies ran the same baseline inbounds play pretty much the entire time at UNLV. He'd just have two guys set a cross screen for each other on the block. It never works because it's the simplest play you can run. UNLV got two layups off of that play against New Mexico. Like, they just didn't guard guys. You just set a cross screen, and they just wouldn't guard them. They just didn't know what to do. So they're not good defensively either, and that probably plays into this. But TJ Otzelberger's reasoning for why he wanted to run against New Mexico was interesting, because New Mexico used a 1-3-1 zone early in that game, and Otzelberger afterwards said they had not seen them run that at all this season. So apparently that was new. They threw it at UNLV for the first time. And so Otzelberger said the decision basically was, well, let's just run on them and let's beat the defense up the floor rather than try to out-execute it in the half court. He's like, yeah, it'll be more efficient if we just run up the floor and try to get a layup early rather than let them set up and beat the defense. But that is going back to what he said in the offseason. That's exactly what he said in the offseason. beat the defense before they get set up, get a shot in the first 10 seconds. That's the most efficient time to take a shot because the defense isn't set. So we're now more than halfway through the season. We're 7 games into conference play, and Otzelberger has gone back to what he was preaching in the offseason. It makes me think he actually trusts his team more. And there are a few reasons for it. I think number one is he actually thinks he has a decent defense now. Like, he actually trusts that his defense isn't going to get torched if he tries to score or tries to play fast. So he trusts his defense a lot more now. He thinks he's got good defensive energy and effort out there, and they're actually going to get some stops. But the actual act of playing in transition, Marvin Coleman and Bryce Hamilton have become excellent transition players. If we go back to the non-conference part of the year, there was really only one player you trusted in transition, and that was Amori Hardy. Like, nobody else on the team had a very high efficiency in transition. It was pretty much Amori Hardy. Even Elijah Mitrulong, very poor efficiency in transition before his injury. But now, all of a sudden, Marvin Coleman and Bryce Hamilton have been excellent. Coleman's a great distributor in transition. He often creates fast break opportunities just simply by passing it ahead, right? He'll get the ball in the backcourt, throw it up past half court, and they get a 2-on-1 or a layup or something like that. So even when he's not actually involved in the finishing of the play, he's doing a good job. But overall, he ranks 4th in the Mountain West in efficiency in transition this season. It's a small sample size for him because he hasn't been playing until recently, but he's been good. And then Bryce Hamilton has been phenomenal. He's 19th overall in the Mountain West in transition efficiency, but has the 11th most transition possessions this year, and there are only 5 players in the conference that have more possessions and a higher efficiency than Bryce Hamilton. So he's got a high volume in transition, and he's been pretty efficient at doing it. If you were to pick one UNLV player in transition to score, you're picking him, because he gets to the rim in transition and he finishes better than anybody else. So now, UNLV's got 3 players that can play in transition: Hardy, Coleman, and Hamilton. They've got 3 guys you trust. Hey, put the ball in their hands. Something good is going to happen in transition. 3 times as many as they had in non-conference play. So now Otzelberger's looking around saying, Jesus, I can run now. We can play fast. We can get the ball up the floor and to the rim right away because I've got 2 more guys that can do it. Amori Hardy is like my 3rd best option now in transition, as opposed to being the only one that can do it. It's led to UNLV being the most efficient offense in Mountain West play. In conference games, they're even better than San Diego State has been in offensive efficiency. I do think we'll see some slow games. San Diego State does play slow. They're going to grind you down. I asked Otzelberger if he wanted to keep playing fast or if the last 2 games were just because of the opponents you've played. And he said, basically, we're going to do what we think gives us the best chance to win. So there probably will be some games where he's like, all right, well, we can't beat this team in transition as easily as we thought. Let's slow it down. So they're probably going to play slow some more, but I think they're going to try to play fast in a lot of games. I bet Wednesday, when they play in Reno, that they're going to try to play fast against Nevada. Like, that's another team that plays fast, and they're probably going to look at that and say, yeah, we can get up the floor and get to the rim right away against this team. So TJ Otzelberger has gone back and forth now on what he wants to do with this team offensively, what he wants this offensive identity to be, and this way is so much more fun. As he gets so much more fun to win. Even if they lose a game, at least they scored 78 points or 85 points and lost, and not 62-58. So much more fun. Also, he went to a very small lineup at one point with 4 guards and Donnie Tillman on the floor, and basically his reasoning was, well, we needed more ball handlers to run in transition. He's like, yeah, we need to run. So, like, Mbaké Jiang played 13 minutes in that game, and the reason is he's like, well, we wanted to run, and Mbaké Jiang, who actually can be decent in transition if he gets up and down the floor, but it's Mbaké Jiang. Like, he's not the ideal pick for...
He's also got frying pans attached to his hands.
Yeah, he made some good catches in that game, actually. But they didn't play Mbaké Jiang very much. He's been one of their most important players this season. They're like, hey, he doesn't really fit for this game. So they ran up and down the floor with 4 guards out there. So, I don't know. It's very much more fun to watch, and they've been successful with it. And I think it's because Otzelberger's like, huh, it's Marvin Coleman, kid. How is he good?
Is this?
I don't know, but he really is. So let's keep running in transition. But so, what's more impressive to you, Bryce Hamilton scoring 35 points or Marvin Coleman posting a triple double?
I mean, Coleman posting a triple double just because he was a walk on that they used like 3 times last year, and we're like, okay, you go back to the bench.
So in general, triple doubles are pretty overrated. Mainly if you're talking about the NBA, like, it's just because it's a 10 points, 10 rebounds, 10 assists. Like, it's in the NBA, it's not that hard to get those numbers, right? Like, it's not that difficult to get the double digits.
We saw two seasons where Russell Westbrook was hunting.
Right.
And he got him.
At the college level, it's more impressive because there's less possessions, less time to actually do it. However, if I told you, hey, Marvin Coleman's going to have 11 points in a game, you wouldn't think that much of it. If I said, hey, he's going to have 12 rebounds, you'd be like, oh, that's kind of high, but still not ridiculous. And if I said, hey, 11 assists, you'd be like, oh, good game.
Wow. Yeah.
Not that ridiculous. So none of those three individual stats are unbelievable. Bryce Hamilton scoring 35 is unbelievable to me. I genuinely cannot believe he scored 35 in a game. This is the guy, last season was the least efficient player on the team. He just took mid-range jumpers. That's all he did. Like, he just took the least efficient shot, and he did not make them. And now, for seven games, he's been in double figures. Last seven games, he's averaging 19.5 points. Even before the 35-point game, he was averaging like 15. Like, he has been very good for seven straight games. And that game against New Mexico, he was excellent in transition. He was unbelievable in the half court. Like, I keep telling you guys about guys that can create their own shot when the offense doesn't work. The way Bryce Hamilton played in the half court on Saturday, he's the best player on the team. Like, if you get anything, like, you don't need the 35 points. Take away anything he did in transition, just what he did in the half court. He's the best offensive player on the team. Because he was like, all right, I'm going to go get to the rim now, guys. Like, I don't care what happened. You guys screwed around for 18 seconds, but I'm going to go get a layup now. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, he just beat New Mexico off the dribble pretty much whenever he wanted. He was phenomenal. And if he can add, he made one good pass, I think have one assist in the game. If he can add a little bit of passing to his game, he's going to be their best offensive player. Like, I love Amari Hardy, and Hardy makes some of the best passes I've ever seen. If Bryce Hamilton can add just a little bit of passing, he's been great for seven games. He was unbelievable in that game on Saturday. Like, his performance is the one that I'm like, no, he can't score 35 in a game. Especially because he did it on 19 shots. That's the most impressive part.
He did it efficiently.
Well, efficiency in college basketball or in all basketball gets sort of rigged by three-point shooting and free throws, right? Those are the two things that people abuse to get high point totals. Bryce Hamilton made two threes and was 5 of 7 on three-pointers. He barely affected the game from three-point range or the free throw line. He was 14 of 19 in the game. He was 12 of 15 on two-pointers. That's how he got almost all of his... Like, that's phenomenal that he got to 35 points and it wasn't because he hit eight threes or because he got 15 free throws. Like, that's ridiculous. You barely even see that anymore. So, I think Bryce Hamilton was more impressive. I also love... Amori Hardy had 12 points, 6 assists, 6 rebounds. It was the fourth most impressive stat line in the game. Marvin Coleman had a triple-double. Bryce Hamilton had 35. Nick Blair had 14 points on 7 of 7 shooting. And then you'd put Amori Hardy's 12, 6, and 6. If you average 12, 6, and 6, you'd be one of the best all-around players in college basketball because only four players in college basketball currently average 12, 6, and 6 this season. None of them are in the Mountain West. There are only three Mountain West players that even average 12 points and 6 rebounds. So nobody in the Mountain West is averaging 12, 6, and 6. So, like, if you did that every game for the whole season, you'd be like, he's one of the best all-around players in college basketball, averaging 12, 6, and 6. Hardy does it in a game, and you're like, maybe the fourth best player. Like, if this was hockey, he wouldn't even get one of the three stars. You're like, you were fine. That's how ridiculous that game was against New Mexico. That's also why playing fast is fun. All right, we got one last thing on UNLV basketball here. Marvin Coleman's game on Saturday, nearly perfect, but he slipped up in the post-game press conference. Here is one of his answers. See if you can catch what he did wrong.
It's just, you know, telling the league that we're here. You know, we don't want to get too high with this one. We still want to stay level-headed, but we still have a tough stretch coming up. We got to go up north and play Nevada, and we have San Diego State after that. So, you know, we're gonna take this one, and we're going to, you know, keep it under our bag, but we still have to work.
Did you catch it?
Yeah.
We have to go up north
and play Nevada.
Oh, my God, Marvin Coleman. That has to be worse than being late for practice, right?
What's his major? Maybe it's journalism. He's a big AP style guide guy.
Marvin Coleman went from triple-double hero to hated by the fans because he didn't use Reno and instead used Nevada. Coming up, Pete DeBoer and Gerard Gallant. They're like the same coach, right? They love getting behind 3-0.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at Bischoff_Tyler.
There's a twist on it.
He did.
A twist, and it turned it around.
We should have thought of that.
We were so
confused. It's still a stupid
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever.
Yeah, it's just clever. A turnabout.
Tyler Bischoff is technically correct.
I would like to point out that Jake Bischoff scored a goal over the weekend for the Chicago Wolves. He has more professional goals this year than Nick Hague does. But the only thing funnier than the Golden Knights falling behind 3-0 in the first period in Pete DeBoer's second game is if they had done it in the first game. But that is why you fire your coach and hire a new one right before Ottawa so that that doesn't happen. But what was different about the Golden Knights falling behind 3-0 in Montreal compared to the deficits that Gerard Gallant faced is that the Golden Knights did not dominate the game against Montreal. They did have a strong advantage in Corsi because Montreal did a good job of keeping them to the outside, and Vegas, in turn, ended up giving up a lot of chances right in front of the net, but not a lot of chances from the outside. So at the end of regulation, the expected goals in that game were 3.1 to 2.1 in favor of Montreal. Most of the time in the games where the Golden Knights get down 3-0 under Gerard Gallant, the Golden Knights had a significant advantage in expected goals in Corsi. Like, all the analytics said, oh yeah, they're the better team tonight. They just, their goalie gave up 3 goals on like 7 shots to start the game, so they lost. So that's the one thing that's different. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Like, it's frustrating when it's like, oh, we played better than the opponent, but we're down 3-0. Like, that's extremely frustrating. That's not really what happened, but at least when you played better than your opponent, you have something to point to say, hey, we did well. When the other team outplays you and you still go down 3-0, it's like, eh, we didn't do anything good. So I don't know exactly what's worse, but there is a somewhat difference to the way the Golden Knights went down 3-0 against Montreal compared to what they were doing against or with Gerard Gallant. Now, the Pacific Division is spectacular. Vancouver currently leads the division with 58 points. Edmonton, Calgary, Vegas, and Arizona all have 57. 1 point separates 5 teams. Now, they've all played different number of games. Like, Vegas and Arizona have each played 51. That's more than anybody else. I think Vancouver and Edmonton have only played 49 right now. So you can fall, the Golden Knights can fall further behind by simply not playing. And Vegas actually has one more game before the All-Star break. So if they win that, they'll have the most points in the division at the All-Star break, but only the fourth best record because they will have played 3 more games than most of the other teams in the division. So it's very stupid, the Pacific Division right now. But here's what I'm hoping for. A team in the Eastern Conference misses the playoffs with more points than the winner of the Pacific Division in the West. And it is very, very possible. Right now, Vancouver leads the Pacific Division 58 points. 7 teams in the Eastern Conference have a better record than Vancouver. Philly and Columbus have 58 points in 49 games, the same exact mark as the Vancouver Canucks. So the 8th and 9th best teams in the West, or in the East, excuse me, have the same exact record as Vancouver. Plus Toronto, who's got the 10th best record in the East, has 57. They've got the same amount of points as the Golden Knights right now in 2 fewer games. So there's a chance that not only one, there's a chance that like 3 teams in the East have a better record than the winner of the Pacific Division and do not make the playoffs, and it would be spectacular. Like, it would be one for last season. Montreal missed the playoffs despite having more points than both Vegas and Colorado, but Vegas was 3 in the Pacific and Colorado was a wild card team. It would be something even funnier if a division winner has less points than a team that misses the playoffs on the other side. It would be terrific.
I mean, isn't that literally what happened with the NFC East?
Well, yeah, it happens in football because you play 16 games. And so, like, and
just used to happen a lot involving the NFC East.
Oh, yes, yes. But, like, it happens in football because of the small season, the small sample size you get, and because each division gets at least one team in.
You've got to put all your bad teams into one division.
When you play 82, there should be some normalization, but not in the Pacific. The Pacific's just bad. We also must thank the great game of hockey. It's a very dumb sport. There's a lot of dumb things that happen in this sport, but we often get excellent, excellent things in hockey. Montreal and Vegas going to a shootout. Thank you to the NHL for that, because they went to an extra round, and the game-winning goal was from Tomáš Tatar.
Tatar!
So
good.
Is that the best sound we've ever had on this show?
The Tatar sound?
Yeah.
I mean, we get to use it a lot more than I thought we
would. Yeah, he's gone, but we still get to use it. He didn't score in regulation, but they got to a shootout, and he scored the game-winning shootout goal, so we still got to use it. And even though I call hockey dumb, we'll always call hockey dumb, sometimes it does dumb things like that that I can be thankful for. Tomas Tatar, what a hero.
Yo, suck it,
Tyler!